It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we find out why good grammar is still important and how to avoid some of the most common mistakes.
First, Governor Walker is on Capitol Hill today meeting with high-level House Republicans. Among other things, he's promoting Wisconsin as an example to consider in their plans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
According to media reports, House Speaker Paul Ryan also invited Walker to share lessons he learned from dealing with Wisconsin's large-scale protests in 2011. They hope it'll help Republicans deal with angry constituents at town hall meetings over Obamacare.
J.R. Ross joins us now. He's editor at wispolitics.com. J.R., welcome back to Central Time.
How are you guys doing today?
Good, thanks. Well, as we know, Governor Walker is urging congressional Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare, but to do what he says the Wisconsin way. What is the Wisconsin way that he's calling for when it comes to health care?
Well, there are kind of two pieces of this, really. One is a little bit of self-interest in how we did Medicaid, and two, it's the lessons that Walker has learned from going back to the fight over Act 10 and the attempt to recall him in 2012. So let's start with the Medicaid piece. Walker very much wants to make sure that we are not hurt by whatever Republicans do in terms of repealing or replacing, or both, Obamacare. When this was expanded, Walker said, no, we're not going to take the federal money to expand. We're going to do things differently. We're going to, you know, make sure we cover everybody under the certain poverty level with Medicaid, and then we're going to tell you, if you're in this other pool of folks with your income, we're going to use basically Affordable Care Act, those pools, to cover you. He thought that was a conservative way to do it. His fear now, though, is that when they do this, the states that didn't take the expansion may get penalized. So he's hoping to kind of keep Wisconsin whole, not take a hit for the way that it did it, because other states took the expansion. So how do you treat a state like Ohio, for example, that did the expansion versus Wisconsin that didn't? So there's that piece. The other piece is, this is Governor Walker that we've kind of seen for the last 6 years, 5 years, talking about nationally about being reformers. If you go back to 2012 after the recall, what Governor Walker has kind of learned from that whole experience, he said, he told us, is he should have explained things more before he proposed the bill and made the case. And so he's been telling people for a long time, make the case and be a reformer. Go big and bold. He says that constantly. Go big and bold. And if you go big and bold, people will respect that.
And on Monday, Governor Walker met with President Trump at the White House, where they discussed health care, among other things. And this is what Governor Walker had to say.
Health care. You know, it's a concern we all have. I mean, we as governors, we want personalized, patient-centered health care that treats people not like a number, but like a human being. And I think that's a common sense that we want. And certainly something the president talked and was very interested in. As I came back, Vecteri and I and others were listening to his Secretary of Health and Human Services. I'm hopeful we'll have a plan that goes beyond repeal and gets to a replace and reform plan that helps all of the people in Wisconsin, Virginia, everywhere else.
And, J.R., one aspect of what the governor's talking about is block grants and how Wisconsin feels about that, and the Republican Governors Association in general and the federal government. Is this something that is being looked at with a more nuanced approach than, say, it did in the fall?
Well, they're preparing for the possibility of block grants being part of Medicaid going forward. But if you look at the budget that Walker proposed about a month ago now, he didn't assume that's going to happen. He kind of did maintaining things as is, because we just don't know. I mean, if you follow the national debate over Affordable Care Act, the Republicans aren't on the same page right now. They're still trying to figure things out. We don't have a bill. We don't have an outline. They've talked about ideas, and there are, even within the House GOP caucus, you know, with Speaker Ryan from Janesville leading the effort, there's not total agreement there yet. So you can't really plan for what's going to look like until you see a draft. So we're kind of all holding our breath and waiting. What's going to happen? What will it look like? How will it impact the way we did things in Wisconsin? And then for Walker and lawmakers, how will it impact the budget that they're doing? It sounds a little bit like they're going to proceed as is. And then let's say this fall, Congress does something. They could always come back and then revamp the program or how it's operated here, depending on what the feds do in Congress.
And what has the governor said about his idea that he was favoring here in Wisconsin of requiring drug testing for Medicaid applicants?
So this is part of Governor Walker's second act. Remember, Act 10 that was what made Walker's name nationally, right? I mean, he took on the public employee unions, and the way he put it, and put the power back in the hands of taxpayers. That gave him a national reputation. Ever since, when Governor Walker's been looking for what's the next big thing for him to tackle. For him, if you look at this budget and a little bit of the last one, he's been trying to find ways, as he puts it, to make welfare programs a hand up, not a handout, to move towards self-sufficiency, to get people into work. He wants to fill jobs in Wisconsin. So to him, he makes the argument that drug screening and testing for some of these welfare programs is a way to do that, because he says he hears from employers saying, we can't find folks to fill the jobs that we have. Requiring work searches or work certain hours to be get food stamps, for example, that's part of, in his mind, getting people moved towards self-sufficiency. Now, obviously, there's a different mindset from other folks in the Capitol saying, wait a second, you're penalizing some of the most vulnerable among us. What's going on here? But for him, it is kind of a call to the next big thing he wants to tackle in government.
Is it something that could potentially have some appeal at the national level among a Republican-led Congress?
Oh, absolutely. And what's interesting is when Walker released his budget and started talking about, like, for example, food stamps, if you're an able-bodied adult, or if you're providing help, people who have kids even school age, providing child care, providing work training, some Democrats told me, look, if he's really serious about providing job training, about giving people the help they need to find a job, you could find bipartisan support. But if it's just going to be having people run around and fill out resumes that aren't helping them, stuff that isn't really helping get a job, you'll find some pushback there. So we're still not quite sure what this is going to look like and how it's going to work. But politically, it's something that's very popular. I mean, if you go up, somebody told me when this came out, if you go up northern Wisconsin and go sit down in a bar somewhere in Rhinelander and say, hey, do you think somebody should have to be looking for a job to get food stamps? They'll probably say, heck yeah. So in that regard, people generally see that as a way to get back to work, and they're going to be okay with it. Obviously, again, there's still a pocket saying, wait, what's going on? What's this going to look like? How's it going to work?
We're talking with J.R. Ross right now, editor of WisPolitics.com, talking about Governor Walker. He is in Washington right now talking about Wisconsin's model for health care. Also, talking about how he dealt with protesters during Act 10 as Republicans across the country face some difficult crowds, sometimes of angry constituents. And we have a little bit of the governor talking about that.
A few years ago, when there were hundreds of thousands of protesters here in our Capitol, occupying the Capitol, that's right, the Occupy movement didn't start in Wall Street, it started right up the way here in Madison on my street. But we didn't back down. We listened to people, we were thoughtful and respectful, but along the way, we ultimately did the things that we said we were going to do. Instead of running away, we ran forward and ran through the pushback that we received. And our state, and most importantly, our citizens are that much better off because of it. I think the same thing's true with the President and the House and the Senate. They clearly ran on an agenda. They laid out that agenda. The voters responded accordingly. And yeah, there's some pushback, just like there was here in Wisconsin. But I think the key is to be respectful and thoughtful, but continue to keep moving America forward, just like we have here and other governors and lawmakers have done across the country.
And JR, as we start to wrap up, are lawmakers receptive to what the governor has to share about his own experiences? Another thing he said is, address the issues. Don't work around them, work through them. Is there receptivity there?
The state level, absolutely. I mean, they've been through the fire, if you will, with Governor Walker the last 6 years and come out the other side. So they're trying to use them as an example for, hey, guys in Congress, it's okay if you try this. Now, obviously, if you talk to some teachers about Governor Walker being respectful in this conversation or some government employees, they will object to him saying he's been respectful through the entire process. That said, Governor Walker believes that basically what happened in Wisconsin reinforced or confirmed his approach. I mean, look at it. He survived a recall election. He won re-election in 2014. I mean, he feels like because they did it the way they did, that if people follow that path, they'll be in good shape as well.
J.R., thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Have a great day.
That was J.R. Ross, editor at WisPolitics.com, talking about Governor Walker's efforts to make Wisconsin a national model for repealing and replacing Obamacare and dealing with protests.
Coming up, our guest says that grammar still matters, and she shares some tricks for avoiding some of the most common mistakes. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, Wisconsin roads are in worse shape now than they were a few years ago, and state lawmakers and the governor have yet to agree on a long-term solution. As Sean Johnson reports, it's gotten so bad in some Wisconsin towns that they're turning paved roads into gravel.
There's a road in the western Wisconsin town of Northfield that used to be completely covered in pavement. But in the last few years, a lot has changed.
This is as far as we got when we fixed that intersection down there.
Richard Erickson has been Northfield's town chair for about 34 years. 2 years ago, his town of about 600 in Jackson County repaired the intersection where this road starts. Northfield ordered new blacktop and told the road builders to keep paving until they ran out of material.
So this line that we're looking at right here, where it turns from pavement to gravel,
this is where we ran out of money 2 years ago, yeah.
They only had enough money to pave 0.2 miles, but that still left a lot of old road that was badly damaged. So, instead of just leaving the potholes, Northfield ground up the pavement and covered it in gravel. Erickson says his town has turned 12 miles of pavement back to gravel since 2010.
You're not forced directly to go to it, but I mean, you end up doing it. We have to try and keep the road somewhat smooth so people can drive on them. And when the funds are short, it's just the best thing we could do.
Erickson and other town chairs like him say Wisconsin state government has put them in a bind. State funding for local governments in the form of municipal aid has been cut over the last decade. Local transportation funding has remained roughly flat. And the state has limited how much towns can raise from local property taxes. Those limits grew stricter under Governor Scott Walker. Meanwhile, the cost of building roads has, over the long term, gone up. Steve Dickinson chairs the town of Garfield in Jackson County. His town was paving new roads in the 90s. Not anymore.
We were so optimistic in the early 90s, and we had, I tell you, it was just fun to be here because folks would come in here and they were just smiles and they were like, yeah, my road will be next. And, you know, we had this plan and it just, like I said, it ended.
Dickinson says he recently had to turn a mile of his town's paved roads back to gravel too. The town has since repaved it with a grant, not from the state of Wisconsin, but from the Ho-Chunk Nation. Governor Walker's budget proposal would increase local road aid by 8.5%. The Wisconsin Towns Association says that translates to an increase of about $10,000 for the average town, enough for maintenance, but not much else. And while gravel roads are cheaper to build, Towns Association Director Mike Colas says they're more expensive to maintain.
So you have a choice. Do we take it from what we have now that is a safety hazard and turn it into gravel, which is not a safety hazard, or do we borrow money to try to fix it the right way?
That's the situation in Northfield, Wisconsin, where over the past 6 years they turned 12 miles of paved roads into gravel. This year, Town Chair Richard Erickson is hoping to reverse that trend. He wants to turn about a mile of gravel road back into pavement, but it will come with a trade-off.
Yeah, we have to borrow money. We just, to pave a mile of road, you know, it's going to cost $60,000 to $80,000. And our budget is just over $100,000. You know, if you pave 1 mile of road, well, you've spent just about your whole year's budget.
It's a small town problem, and at least for now, it's still relatively rare in Wisconsin. But nearly 62,000 miles of Wisconsin roads are maintained by towns, which means local road issues have big implications. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a 5-part series Wisconsin Public Radio is airing this week, looking at transportation challenges. You can hear the rest of the series at WPR.org/roads.
Now, National Grammar Day is coming up this Saturday, so we thought it was a good time to get a little refresher on some of the most common grammatical mistakes and how to avoid them.
Writing and grammar expert Kathleen Watson splits her time, but not her infinitives, between Wisconsin and Arizona. She's the author of Grammar for People Who Hate Rules, Killer Tips from the Ruthless Editor. You can also get answers to more grammar questions from her weekly blog posts at ruthlesseditor.com. Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's delightful to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into some specific advice, Kathleen, make the case. Why does grammar still matter to us?
It matters because we are judged on the way we write and speak. And people are doing more writing now than they ever have. We have texts and emails. Emails is the primary business communication mode. We're posting on Facebook. We're posting on LinkedIn. So it's a very public venue. And when people see errors in writing, we're judged by those. So it pays to pay attention to grammar, even today.
Let's get to some of the more common mistakes that we can make in this arena. One of them is when to use me and when to use I in a sentence. This is one of those that I think a lot of people still get confused about, even though you were probably taught it in grade school and maybe it just didn't sink in.
I agree, and I have a theory on it. I think we can blame our moms. When kids are young, they'll often say, "Hey, Mom, me and Billy are going for a bike ride." Or, "Hey, Mom, can me and Sarah have a lemonade stand?" And Mother corrects us, having us put the other person's name in front of our own. And so I think we get so accustomed to thinking me is the wrong thing that we avoid it entirely. But if you look at just a quick example of a quick sentence, my boss is taking Jim and I to lunch. To most people, that would sound correct. But to be sure, eliminate one person from it. Eliminate Jim. Would you say, my boss is taking I to lunch? Of course not. You would say, my boss is taking me to lunch. So when you put Jim back in the equation, the correct way is, my boss is taking Jim and me to lunch.
And in either case, would we say myself?
Yes. I see that a lot in business. Either contact Jim or myself if you have questions. Here again, if you delete one or the other from the equation, please contact Jim if you have questions. Please contact myself if you have questions. Of course you wouldn't say myself. You would say me. So again, me is the proper word rather than the reflective version, which is myself.
Some of these are tricky when they happen in real time. If you're writing, you can probably take a moment to go, okay, Rob and me instead of Rob and I. But if you're speaking, you know, it's hard to perform those mental acrobatics on the fly.
I agree. And that's why if you can find an example that's easy to recall, something that sticks in your memory, which is what my book is based on, examples rather than rules. Nobody can remember complicated grammar rules, nor do they have any interest in it. But if you can try to remember an example, that can help you when you're speaking and don't have the time to double-check as you do when you're writing.
Veronica and I are talking to Kathleen Watson, author of Grammar for People Who Hate Rules. Kathleen is talking to Veronica and me. I think I got all that right. Yes,
you did indeed.
Now, here's another one that comes up a lot. When I'm writing for radio, too, I have to catch myself on this one. When to use that and when to use who?
The easiest guide is that who is for people, living people. That is for animals. In fact, there's an even further guideline, animals without a name. Again, I like to pull out examples. So if you're saying the person who joined our book club fits in well, or the person that joined our book club fits in well, who is the person? Who is the animate part? So you would use who. If you're saying the kitten that got caught in the rain seemed lost, the kitten doesn't have a name, so it's for unnamed things. The kitten who got caught in the rain seemed lost. The kitten is a that. If you say Jezebel, the kitten that got lost in the rain, now it has a name. So you say Jezebel, the kitten who got caught in the rain, now is a part of our family.
That's a fun rule. I knew about the using who for people, but I didn't know that
named
pets or animals were an exception.
That's a fine distinction.
Yeah. And that's one, I think you even quoted then President Barack Obama, getting this one wrong.
Yes, both he and John McCain, I remember hearing. Yeah, his was, I think, the president that's got your back, when it should have been the president who has your back.
One of the biggest challenges, this is an easy one for speaking out loud, but in print, apostrophes, when to use them, this seems like a really common stumbling block for people.
It is, and probably because there are so many different scenarios where we use apostrophes that it's hard to remember which one to use when. And one of the most common is just the very often used word it's. And I think it's a problem because it's as a possessive, we learn a rule, a guideline, that when you want to make something possessive, you add apostrophe S. You would say, Sam's bike is in the garage, S-A-M apostrophe S. But when you're using it's, such as in the case where, when we were talking about the kitten lost its collar, No, I'm sorry. That's the wrong example. Let's say the kitten licked its paw. You wouldn't have an apostrophe S there. That's the possessive form. So it violates the rule, and that's what we have a hard time with. We always want to make possessive with an apostrophe. The apostrophe is reserved for the contraction it is.
But then this gets pretty a fine point on it when you talk about things that are descriptive, for instance. I think I tried the teacher's, I remember the example you had, and the teacher's bank or something like that. What do you do then?
Yes. That, again, it involves the possessive, but when is a word possessive and when is it descriptive? If you say the teacher's lounge, for example, the lounge doesn't really belong to the teachers. It's someplace for them as a plurality to gather. So there would not be an apostrophe with teachers, the teacher's lounge. If you were to say the Mac users group, the group doesn't belong to them. It's something that's formulated to serve their purposes. So then users would not have an apostrophe. It would be considered descriptive instead of possessive.
I got to say, that's the one that probably baffles me the most. I'm sure you could go to WPR.org and find examples of me, Rob Barrett, getting that one wrong. Is that the case? Kathleen, does everybody have their own problem that just our foil in grammar that we're always going to keep messing up?
I suspect that's the case, and I think we've talked about a couple of them today. I think me is one that's always going to be a challenge, and I think its is always going to be a challenge. One thing about its, if you have it in a sentence, always substitute it is and apply it to that, and you'll know right away. You wouldn't say the kitten licks it is paw. Mm-hmm. So that's one guideline that's easily applied in your head or on paper.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
That's writing and grammar expert Kathleen Watson. She's the author of the book Grammar for People Who Hate Rules, Killer Tips from the Ruthless Editor. You can get answers to more grammar questions from her weekly blog posts at ruthlesseditor.com.
Coming up after the news, we talk with a scientist who says more members of her field need to be visible in their communities and help increase the public's understanding of their work. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says we're living in dangerous times thanks to the looming death of expertise.
First, how many scientists do you know? For a lot of us, the answer is zero. Our next guest says that's actually a problem.
She believes it prevents people from knowing how scientists do their work and, in turn, from valuing it.
She encourages scientists to become more involved in their communities and for the public to learn more about what goes on in the lab. During a time of divided public and political opinion on issues like climate change and vaccinations, she says bridging that gap could have a real impact.
Sarah Whitlock joins us now. She's a graduate student in molecular biophysics and structural biology at the University of Pittsburgh and a contributor for Stat News. Her recent article is called "A Lot of Americans Don't Know a Single Scientist. We Need to Fix That." Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, you say that in general, scientists have not done a great job of communicating with the public. Why do you think that is?
I think that a lot of scientists have trouble communicating with the general public just because of the time required to do science. It's a lot of time investment. You spend most of your life in the lab working really hard. And so it can be hard to step away and take time to talk to the general public.
Do you think there's a skill, too? I mean, if you're a scientist, you probably spend a lot of time talking to other scientists who might understand more technical language than the general public.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a problem. I know, at least in my daily life, I do spend almost all of my time talking to scientists, and so sometimes I forget the things that the public might not know that I do know, and so that can definitely also add a layer of challenge to communicating with the public.
And in your article, you point out a statistic that most people don't know a scientist personally. What's going on there?
I think it's just, obviously it's going to be a matter of numbers. There aren't as many scientists as there are in the general public. And then a lot of scientists are kind of concentrated in university areas, and there are a few schools, obviously, that are going to be in more rural areas, but coming from a background where I grew up in kind of a rural area in Kansas, I didn't know any scientists until I became a scientist personally, which isn't going to be everyone's experience, but it's definitely, you have to make an effort to know a scientist if you're from an area where there isn't a high concentration of researchers.
So what do you think changes, though, if you actually do know a scientist who's living and working today, not just Einstein, who everybody can name, but what if you know someone who's working in the field right now?
Yeah, so I think, at least in terms of my own interactions with people who I've been friends with for years, I think knowing a scientist can help personalize issues that are otherwise really contentious. So, for instance, talking about climate change with people that I've known, it's a lot easier to kind of communicate with them that this is a real phenomenon that's happening because they're more inclined to trust what I'm telling them, given that they already have that relationship with me.
Do you think people can also evaluate science better if they have more familiarity so that, you know, I mean, it's not as though people have the time in their daily lives to go look at, you know, different studies and see which one had the better peer review and which one was duplicatable. But, I mean, do you think that there is a baseline of knowledge that can help when there's more familiarity there?
Exactly, yeah. And definitely knowing a scientist will help you. It's going to give you a great resource for filtering through all of the data because even research scientists obviously aren't going to be extremely familiar with every single field that's out there. But knowing one will help you to make that distinction for sure.
Well, what do you think better communication from scientists to the general public would look like? If there's an acknowledgement that maybe this needs to improve, what could change?
At least for me and for the students that I know, because I know there is, there's science communication that goes on for sure. There's a lot of great work being done to write articles and to try to reach out to the general public. But I think kind of what needs to really happen is not so much with people who are already doing science communication, but maybe with those of us, including myself, who struggle to get the time to do science communication, to focus more on doing that and to maybe even take some time away from what we would be doing in lab to pursue relationships with people who aren't scientists, to go out and to communicate about what we're doing. Because there's a lot of pressure to get as much done as possible in science, which is understandable. I mean, it's exciting. You want to learn new things. But maybe upping the priority of our communication with the public would be good.
Is there training for scientists as you go through and get your degrees to learn how to talk to the public? Are there any classes that are generally offered saying, look, here's how you can talk about your research to people who aren't scientists?
I think the number of those types of classes is increasing. I think maybe, obviously I can't speak for every institution, but at least in my program personally, there isn't a class that we have to take about talking to the public about our science, but there are competitions that are starting to spring up about who can communicate about their entire thesis project the best in a short amount of time and things like that. So I think that those kinds of classes are definitely on the rise, but I don't think that every scientist for every program is going to be taking one of those in his or her training.
We're talking with Sarah Whitlock right now, graduate student in molecular biophysics and structural biology at the University of Pittsburgh. And we're talking about her recent article called A Lot of Americans Don't Know a Single Scientist. We need to fix that. And Sarah, you mentioned that the science that a lot of us learn in school doesn't really go far enough because it focuses mostly on the conclusions of science. What do you think is missing?
I think what's missing, and what was even missing for me maybe until I was partway through my undergraduate degree in science, was more emphasis on the process of how scientific knowledge is discovered. Because there's so much scientific knowledge out there that a lot of times we're focused on learning all of it, but the process we get there is it's not linear. There's a lot of mistakes and mistaken ideas about how things work that we go through before we get to that final fact.
What do you think would improve that?
So that's a hard question because we do want people to have a base level science understanding, so there does need to be communication of those facts. But I think maybe giving more example research problems and like walking through here's a hypothesis and let's come up with ways to test this and then going through like the failure of a hypothesis and coming up with new ways to test what your idea, that might be good to incorporate something like that into science education.
And some scientists now are feeling the need to advocate for their own field. And there's a march coming up, a march for science in Washington, D.C. next month. What are the issues that are being marched for, do you think?
So I think the issue issues that are most important that are being marched for is scientists really want to see their ability to communicate with the public continue, because there were some concerns with recent statements from the president and his administration that scientists wouldn't be able to communicate clearly, and we're seeing that that's, you know, that's a very important thing to be able to do, and also marching for funding for scientific research and policies that are based on evidence rather than, you know, debate about facts.
There's disagreement among scientists about whether the March for Science is a good idea, or rather, could it harm the causes of science and the idea that science is without bias and based in fact and dispassionate. Do you think that it gets in the way of any of those tenets about what science is?
So is this like, is it politicizing science? Is it going to make it the situation that we're currently in worse? Is that what you're...
Yeah.
So I think that is definitely a concern, and I'm sure that it will in some ways be perceived to make that worse, to make science appear more political. But some issues that are extremely important to science kind of have already been politicized, things like vaccine usage or the climate change issues. And so I think the scientists who are choosing to march think that fighting for those issues is more important than the potential downsides that could arise from greater perception of science being political.
We're talking with Sarah Whitlock right now, graduate student in molecular biophysics and structural biology at the University of Pittsburgh, talking about ways to increase public understanding of science.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think scientists and their work seem too removed from the rest of the public? What would you like to see to change that? Do you think science deserves more respect from the public and in the political sphere? Are you a scientist or a researcher yourself who's worried about the relationship between science and the public? Or do you see signs of hope? If you're not a scientist, do you know any? Do you interact with a scientist at any time in your daily life? Does it change the way you think about scientific issues? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about why many Americans don't personally know a scientist and how that could contribute to a lack of understanding about what scientists do. And we're picking up the conversation with Sarah Whitlock now. She's a graduate student in molecular biophysics at the University of Pittsburgh and a contributor for Stat News.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think science feels too distant from your everyday life? What would it take to make you feel more connected with scientists? If you are a scientist or researcher, do you do any kind of outreach? Do you feel like you could talk to people in the general public about the work you do and about science in general? And for anybody out there, we sometimes hear from our listeners, yeah, we want to hear more science news and science coverage and reporting. Do you want to hear more of that kind of thing? Do you want to hear it directly from the scientists and researchers themselves? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Take our first caller. Now we've got Debbie with us in Madison. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I was thinking that, or hopefully, some of the changes that we're looking at in education, for example, in Common Core, where I know that's a controversial thing, but the whole idea behind it is to encourage students to think deeper and not so broad, but, you know, to really go deep on subjects, and I think that will help them value inquiry and maybe in the long run foster more interest in science and how things happen and why. I also think at the same time when we're kind of cutting back on like the arts, that's another thing that really encourages curiosity and imagination and thinking about why or how things could be. So hopefully some of the changes that we're considering in education will foster more scientific thinking or, you know, curiosity about how things happen and why.
Debbie, thanks a lot for that comment. And Sarah, Debbie is feeling hopeful that broad changes in education could get at some of what you're talking about. And also it sounds like address some of the foundational aspects of how scientists think. What about that?
Yeah, I'm definitely hopeful about changes, too. I in no way wanted to seem like a downer or anything like that. I'm very hopeful about changes to education and how they can foster great creative thinking in both the arts and sciences. So I definitely feel hopeful with Debbie, yes.
Debbie, thanks so much for that call. And we're going to move next to Grant joining us in Madison. Grant, hi.
Hey there. How are you?
Good.
So I only wanted to comment that I think what the guest is talking about is critical, but I think there's an underlying issue as well. And that's that I believe that there needs to be greater understanding of the function of the university in general vis-a-vis basic research. I think the notion that core value of the university in the sort of German university sense, Humboldtian University, that core value is very little understood, and the notion that research is kind of far distant, research in all fields, somehow far distant from reality is, in fact, in a way, the way the university is supposed to work. So I guess that was my sole comment.
All right, Grant, thanks a lot for calling. And what about Grant's comment there, Sarah, about people understanding how research works, the function of the university, and how it's all tied together?
I guess perhaps I don't understand exactly what Grant was saying, but he commented that research was supposed to be far removed from reality. And, I mean, I don't know, I would hope that at least the science that I'm researching isn't far removed from reality in the sense that I want to be coming up with therapeutics, I want to be coming up with cures that are going to be very much relevant to my daily life. So I suppose perhaps in other fields that might be the case, but for science I would hope that it definitely was.
Grant, are you still there? Do you want to comment? You want to chime in?
Oh, am I still on?
Yeah, you can go ahead. Do you want to respond?
Well, I guess I probably misspoke. I maybe over-exaggerated my point. The sole point was that, in fact, one major aspect of the university as an idea is to conduct research for its own sake without a specific end goal in mind sometimes.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
Grant, thanks for that.
Definitely. We want to conduct research for pure knowledge as well as for application purposes, because that is deeply important as well. So, I agree with that for sure.
So do you think some of that big mission stuff could be improved upon, Sarah?
In terms of research for knowledge's sake?
Right, what Grant was talking about there, about, knowledge for knowledge's sake and not always having a utility at the end of everything that's begun.
Well, at least in terms of what I've observed during my time at research universities, I've been positively impressed that that is one thing that our research universities seem to do very well. You know, there's a lot of basic level, at least in biology, basic level research that's being done that we hope will, in the future, produce therapeutics, produce cures. But at the moment, we're just doing research to find out how things work.
Grant, thanks a lot for calling. And we go next to Randy with us in Sauk County. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. I've found out something just as a parent of now a grown man who's a researcher, and that is he majored in organic chemistry and also statistics and things like that. And what I've found now, he also became an MD and has combined all of that and works at the National Institutes of Health and things like that. And being a farmer from, rural Wisconsin, used to think I knew, and a college graduate myself, used to think I knew a lot and blah, blah, blah. And actually what I found is that scientists, once they become professionals, are really good at what they do, and it's based on statistics and things that are relevant. And communicating that statistically is very, very important to them. And I guess my advice is that it's what's relevant statistically, and communicating that in terms of what actually is important, because it makes sense statistically, is what I think is important. And I don't debate my son anymore on, I found out he knows more than I do about things.
Randy, thanks a lot for that. And Sarah, what do you think about Randy's comment there?
I definitely agree that communicating things in terms of statistics is very important. So I completely agree with that. And I do think that scientists typically think statistics are very important.
Talking with Sarah Whitlock right now, talking about her recent article called A Lot of Americans Don't Know a Single Scientist, We Need to Fix That, talking about how to improve communication between scientists and the public. And you can call us at 800-642-1234. We go down to Ashley in Burlington. Ashley, hi.
Hi. I recently completed a NASA SOFIA flight as an ambassador in January. And I was calling that my job as an ambassador to NASA is to bring the knowledge and the research that is happening for infrared astronomy back to my classroom as a 7th and 8th grade science teacher, as well as to the community. So I just wanted to show, like, another way that NASA recognizes the need for research and outreach to the community, and looking at teachers as a way to bridge that gap.
Ashley, that sounds really cool. What did you do as an ambassador for NASA?
So In January, I went on two overnight flights to look at infrared astronomy via the airborne astronomy. It's a modified 747 called SOFIA. And so really working with the scientists to look at their research from methane on Venus and heavy water and regular water, that we were collecting the data, and that I was able to talk with the researchers.
Wow. And how do your students respond when their teacher comes back and has all this cool hands-on science work done with NASA?
I think they're like, whoa, that it's mainly just having the idea that my teacher did that.
You've got street cred.
That I might not be a scientist, but that it's a connection to NASA, that I think sometimes what children envision is the scientist or the astronaut out in space,
right,
doing a spacewalk, that realizing that not all the research is happening in space.
Right, scientists can look different than you think. Right.
Yeah, and then to see them with my pictures and jeans hanging out, that it's a different visual than what you often think.
That's so great. Ashley, thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us. And Sarah, what about that kind of partnership between, you know, people from different disciplines working in different fields, partnering like that? Is that one way to get at this question of communication?
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And I really like the idea of partnering with teachers to help kind of amplify the dissemination of scientific communication, because the more people we have communicating about science, the better. And teachers are just a valuable way to do that, for sure.
What about, you know, beyond teachers? Would there be value in, say, having, you know, like radio hosts go work with NASA?
Oh, yeah.
Or, I don't know, construction workers, other people to get in and do some cross-pollination?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think as many people as we can get excited about science and, like, into the lab, maybe working on scientific projects, even for a brief time, just to get a flavor of how it works, I think that would be fantastic.
Let's take one more quick call here. Lynn is with us in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I am a practitioner of the culinary arts. I'm now retired, but I get to teach my grandchildren the science of cooking and baking. They were excited to learn about yeast and that it's a living organism. And everything from sanitation to the science of nutrition is so involved in what I have done, and that's how I teach the next generation, something I can do.
Lynn,
and it's been fantastic.
Lynn, appreciate that comment, and that's a great point, Sarah. What about bringing science into things that we might not think of as sciencey? You know, baking, for instance.
Yeah, I think baking is a great way. If you know things about how, you know, yeast work and things like that, that's a great way. You know, people are interested in brewing various things. Like, that's a great way to get involved with learning about science and how it's involved in things that you use and enjoy every day.
And, sir, just a couple seconds, but what do you think everyone should know about scientists? What do you wish they knew?
I think I wish that everyone knew that scientists enjoy doing a lot of the same things that they do. So, like, for example, climate scientists enjoy driving their cars around as much as the next person. So just to kind of keep in mind that people who are scientists aren't necessarily making dire predictions without feeling those consequences as well.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Sarah Whitlock, graduate student in molecular biophysics at the University of Pittsburgh, joined us to talk about why the public's understanding of science is so important, she says. Her article about that topic is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay with us. There's more to come.
What if you were just starting out as an actor and could get advice about acting from a Hollywood star?
Well, that's what happened this week when actor Mark Ruffalo chatted via Skype with a group of young actors from St. Joseph Catholic Academy in Kenosha.
We saw this in the Journal Sentinel. Ruffalo was born in Kenosha and lived there until his family moved to Virginia when he was in high school. Ruffalo, famous as playing, among other things, the Green Guy, the Incredible Hulk in the Avengers movie franchise.
He also had a leading role in the Academy Award-winning movie Spotlight, along with a lot of other credits on stage and on screen.
Ruffalo's advice to the young actors, break their hearts, leave it all on the stage.
A student asked Ruffalo about his thoughts on acting in movies versus acting on the stage.
Movies are the director's medium, television is the writer's medium, and the stage is the actor's medium. It's the one place where actors have full control at the end of the day. There's no way he's going to call cut when you blow it. You're not going to be able to save your performance. What you see is what you get. And as good as you are is as good as you'll be.
And hopefully the students didn't anger him with any of their questions.
They wouldn't like him when he's angry.
No, but it was via Skype, so he could only smash puny computer, not the classroom itself. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.